In the morning, a young housemaid woke her with a copy of the Times and a pot of Earl Grey tea, then returned a few minutes later with her hold-all. "Sir Nicholas would like you to take breakfast with him in the dining room at 8:30. While she showered, Rayan inspected her naked body in the full-length mirror that covered one wall of the bathroom. Apart from the knife wound on her arm, which was still livid and only partially healed, there was a dark bruise on her thigh and another down her left flank and buttock, legacies of the car crash. Her shin was scraped raw, and gingerly she pulled a pair of slacks over the injury. She limped a little as she went down the main staircase to find the dining room. "Please help yourself," Nicholas looked up from his newspaper to greet her as she hesitated in the doorway. He waved at the display of breakfast dishes on the sideboard. As she spooned scrambled eggs out onto her plate, she recognised the landscape on the wall in front of her as a constable. "Did you sleep well?" He didn't wait for an answer, but went on. "I've heard from the police. They found the man-truck abandoned in a lay-by near Harrogate. They're going over it now, but they don't expect to find much. We seem to be dealing with someone who knows what he is doing." "I must phone the hospital," she said. "I have already done so. Your mother had an easy night. I left a message that you would visit her this evening." "This evening?" She looked around sharply. "Why so late?" "I intend to keep you busy until then. I want to get my money's worth out of you." He stood as she came to the table and drew back her chair to seat her. She found the courtesy made her feel slightly uncomfortable, but she made no comment. "The first attack on you and Duryed at your villa in the Oasis, we can draw no conclusions from that, apart from the fact that the assassins knew exactly what they were after and where to look for it." She found the abrupt change of subject disconcerting. "However, let's give some thought to the second attempt in Cairo, the hand grenade. Who knew you were going to the ministry that afternoon, apart from the minister himself?" She reflected as she chewed and swallowed a mouthful of egg. "Oh, I'm not sure. I think I told Duryed's secretary. Maybe one of the other research assistants." He frowned and shook his head. "So half the museum staff knew about your appointment." "That's about it, yes. Sorry." He pondered a moment. "All right. Who knew you were leaving Cairo? Who knew you were staying at your mother's cottage?" "One of the clerks from administration brought my slides out to the airport." "Did you tell him what flight you were leaving on?" "No, definitely not." "Did you tell anybody at all?" "No. That is..." She hesitated. "Yes?" "I told the minister himself during our interview when I asked for leave of absence." "Not him. Surely not." Her expression reflected her horror at the thought. Nicholas shrugged. "Some funny things happen. Of course, the minister knew all about the work that you and Duryed were doing on the Seventh Scroll." "Yes, not all the details, but yes, in general terms, he knew what we were up to." "All right. Next question. Tea or coffee?" He poured coffee into her cup and then went on. "You said that Duryed had a list of possible sponsors for an expedition. Might give us some ideas as to a short list of suspects." "The Getty Museum," she said, and he smiled. "Yes, we'll cross that one from the list. They don't go around tossing grenades in the streets of Cairo. Who else was there on the list?" "Gotthold Ernst von Schiller." "Hamburg, heavy industry, metal and alloy refineries, base mineral production." Nicholas nodded. "Who was the third name on the list?" "Peter Walsh," she said, "the Texan." "Ah, that's the one," he nodded. "Lives in Fort Worth, fast food franchising, mail order retail." There were very few collectors with the substance to compete with the major institutions when it came to making significant acquisitions of antiquities or to financing archaeological exploration. Nicholas knew them all, for it was a mutually antagonistic circle of no more than a couple of dozen men. He had competed with each of them, at one time or another, on the auction floors of Sotheby's and Christie's, not to mention other less salubrious venues where fresh antiquities were sold. The adjective fresh was used in the context of fresh out of the ground. "Those are two beady-eyed bandits. They'd probably eat their own children if they felt peckish. What would they do if they thought you stood in the way of the tomb of Mamoz? Do you know if either of them contacted Duryed after the book was published, the way I did? I don't know. They may have. I cannot imagine that either of those beauties would have missed such an easy trick. We must believe that they both know that Duryed had something going on. We will put their names on our list of suspects. Then he inspected her plate. Enough? Another spoonful of egg? No? Very well, let's go down to the museum and see what Mrs. Street has found for us to work on. When they walked into his study, she was impressed by the amount of organization that he had accomplished in such a short time. He must have been busy at it all last night, turning the room into a military-type headquarters. In the center of the room stood a large easel and blackboard, on which were pinned a set of overlapping satellite photographs. She went across to study them, and then glanced at the other material pinned on the board. Along with a large-scale map covering the same area of southwestern Ethiopia as the satellite photographs, there were lists of names and addresses, lists of equipment and stores which he had obviously used on previous African expeditions, sheets of calculations of distance and what looked like a preliminary financial budget. At the top of the board was a schedule headed Ethiopia, General Information. There were five closely typed foolscap sheets, so she did not read through the entire schedule, but she was impressed by his thoroughness in preparation. Royan determined to study all this material at the earliest opportunity, but now she crossed to one of the two chairs he had set up at a table facing the board. He stood at the board and picked up a silver-topped swagger stick from the table, brandishing it like a schoolmaster's pointer. "Class will come to order," he rapped on the board. "The first thing you have to do is convince me that we will be able to pick up the spoor of Taita again after it has had several thousand years to cool. Let us first consider the geographical features of the Abai Gorge." Nicholas described the course of the river on the satellite photograph with his pointer. "Along this section, the river has cut its way through the flood basalt plateaus. In places, the cliffs of the sub-gorge are sheer, as high as 400 or 500 feet on each side. Where there are intrusive strata of harder igneous schists, the river has not been able to erode them. They form a series of gigantic steps in the course of the river. I think you are correct in your assumption that Taita's steps are actually waterfalls." He came to the table and picked out a photograph from amongst the bundles of papers that covered it. "I took this in the gorge during the Armed Forces expedition in 1976. It will give you an idea of what some of those falls are like." He passed her a black and white riverscape of towering cliffs on either side, and a cascade of water that seemed to fall from the heavens to dwarf the tiny figures of half-naked men and boats in the foreground. "Oh, I had no idea it was like that." She stared at it in awe. "Doesn't do justice to the splendid desolation down there in the gorge," he told her. "From a photographer's point of view, there is no place to stand from which you can get it all into perspective. But at least you can see how that waterfall would halt a party of Egyptians coming upriver on foot, or at least with pack horses. There's usually some sort of path alongside the cataracts, made by elephant and other wild game over the ages. However, there's simply no way to bypass waterfalls such as this one, and to get around those cliffs." She nodded, and he went on. "Even coming downstream, we had to lower the boats and all our equipment down each set of waterfalls on ropes. It wasn't easy. Let us agree that it was a waterfall that stopped them going further. The second waterfall from the westerly approaches," she conceded. Nicholas picked up the swagger stick, and on the satellite photograph traced the course of the river up from the dark wedge shape of the Rosiris Dam in central Sudan. "Now, the escarpment rises on the Ethiopian side of the border. That is where the gorge proper begins. No roads or towns there, and only two bridges far upstream. Nothing for 500 miles except racing Nile waters and savage black basalt rock." He paused to let that sink in. "It is one of the last true wildernesses on earth, with an evil reputation, as the haunt of wild animals and even wilder men. I have marked the main falls that show in the gut of the gorge here on the satellite photo. With the pointer, he picked them out, each circled neatly in red marker pen. Here is waterfall number 2, about 120 miles upstream from the Sudanese border. However, there are a number of factors we have to consider, not least the fact that the river may have altered its course during the last 4,000 years since our friend Taita visited it. Surely it could not have escaped from such a deep canyon. 4,000 feet, she protested. Even the Nile must be held captive by that. Yes, but it would certainly have altered the existing bed. In the flood season, the volume and force of the river exceeds my ability to describe it to you. The river rises 20 meters up the side walls and bores through at speeds of 10 knots or more. You navigated that? She asked doubtfully. No, not in the flood season. Nothing could survive that. They both stared at the photograph in silence for a minute, imagining the terrors of that mighty stretch of water in its full fury. Then she reminded him. The second waterfall? Oh, here it is, where one of the tributary rivers enters the main flow of the Abay. The tributary is the Dandera River, and it rises at 12,000 feet altitude below the peak of Sankai Mountain in the Choke Range, here about 100 miles north of the gorge. Do you remember the spot where it joins the Abay, from when you were there? Oh, it was over 20 years ago now, and even then we had been almost a month down there in the gorge, so it all seemed to merge into a single nightmare. The memory blurred with the monotonous surroundings of the cliffs and the dense jungle of the walls, and our senses were dulled by the heat and the insects and the roar of water and the repetitive, unremitting toil at the oars. But strangely, I do remember the confluence of the Dandera and Abay for 2 reasons. Yes? She sat forward eagerly, but he shook his head. We lost a man there, the only casualty on the second expedition. Rope parted and he fell 100 feet. Landed on his back across a spur of rock. I am sorry. But what was the other reason you remember the spot? There is a Coptic Christian monastery there, built into the rock face about 400 feet above the surface of the river. Down there, in the depths of the gorge? She sounded incredulous. Why would they build a monastery there? Ethiopia is one of the oldest Christian countries on earth. It has over 9,000 churches and monasteries, a great many of them in similarly remote and almost inaccessible places in the mountains. This one at the Dandera River is the reputed burial site of Saint Frumentius, the saint who introduced Christianity to Ethiopia from the Byzantine Empire in Constantinople in the early 3rd century. Legend has it that he was shipwrecked on the Red Sea shore and taken to Aksum, where he converted the emperor Ezana. Did you visit the monastery? Oh, hell no, he laughed. We were too busy just surviving, too eager to escape from the hell of the gorge to have any time for sightseeing. We descended the falls and kept on downriver. All I remember of the monastery are the excavations in the cliff face high above the pool of the river, and the distant figures of the troglodytic monks in their white robes lining the parapet of the caves to watch impassively as we passed. Some of us waved up to them and felt quite rebuffed when they made no response. How would we ever reach that spot again without a full-scale river expedition? She wondered aloud, staring disconsolately at the board. Discouraged already? He grinned at her. Wait until you meet some of the mosquitoes that live down there. They pick you up and fly with you to their lairs before they eat you. Oh, be serious, she entreated him. How would we ever get down there? The monks are fed by the villagers, who live up in the highlands above the gorge. Apparently there's a goat track down the wall. They told us that it takes 3 days to get down that track into the gut of the gorge from the rim. Could you find your way down? No, but I have a few ideas on the subject. We'll come to that later. Firstly, we must decide what we expect to find down there after 4,000 years. He looked at her expectantly. Your turn now. Convince me. He handed her the silver-headed pointer, dropped into the chair beside her, and folded his arms.